As we open to Exodus chapter 20 today, let's remind ourselves of the environment in which this is about to happen. God wants to meet with the Israeli people in a very powerful way to deliver his covenant with them, a covenant which they've already verbalized that they want to enter into with him, to be his special treasure, to be his kingdom of priests and his holy nation, his holy ethnic group, to basically represent him to the world. So they verbalize they'd like to do that. So God says, all right, this is how we're going to do it. 3 days from today, you're going to come en masse to the edge of the mountain, and I'm going to come down and voice the covenant with you. So the Israelis are supposed to prepare by getting some freshly washed clothing for Sunday morning. They have to abstain from things like sexual activity that would make them ceremonially unclean for this particular day. They can't go past a certain boundary, and they are to be ready to receive the word of God. So the third day has come. It's the first day of the week. It's Pentecost. It's the 50th day since the first day of the week that fell during the time of their exodus from Egypt. And the mountain is shaking. The sound of the shofar, apparently sounded by an angel, is sounding louder and louder and louder. The presence of God, invisible form as a cloud, is on fire, and there's lightning shooting out of it, and it's descending down onto the top of the mountain. God calls for Moses to come up and get some last-minute instructions from him. Moses does so, goes back down, warns the people, all right, now God is ready to talk to you. Nobody go across the boundary. And everybody is absolutely scared to death almost because of this. And then God speaks. Exodus chapter 20, verse number 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am he who is your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, this is God introducing himself officially for the very first time to all of these people. And he uses his special name that he already talked to Moses about and reminds them, I'm the one who brought you to this place out of Egyptian slavery. Commandment number 1, verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. And it's actually alongside me. There is to be no other worship going on other than of the one true God. Commandment number 1. Very clear, shouldn't be a problem, should be understood that there is no other God but he who created the universe. Commandment number 2, starting at verse number 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I am he who is your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now let's start with the second part first. When God says here that he visits the iniquity of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generation, he is not saying that he punishes specifically the children for the sins of their parents, because he will give instructions later that that is immoral, that the children should not be punished or executed directly for the sins of their parents, the actions of their parents. What's being expressed here is what we refer to as consequences. So God is saying, I will permit the consequences of the fathers, the mothers, to radiate outward for several generations. Now, what's the point of that? The point of that is you need to behave yourself for the sake of those that follow you. Every last one of us understand this concept. We are none of us islands. Each of us interact with other people, specifically those in our own family and those of us who are parents. We know that our interaction with our children and our grandchildren and even our great-grandchildren have long-lasting impact. So we need to control our actions, knowing that. We need to be holy as God is holy, so that our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids can see that and hopefully learn from it. Because if we don't, then we are teaching them the opposite. If we engage in sinful behavior in front of them, we are telling them it's okay to do these things. And it's going to cause trouble. And since the family is the basic unit of a community, which is the basic unit of a nation, the weakest link causes trouble. Now, not only does God warn them about consequences, he does remind them that he wants to show love and concern and compassion for any and all of those that want this relationship. We've got this foolishness that's grown up through the centuries since the Bible was written down, that the Old Testament God was a God of vengeance and fire and death and punishment and rage and wrath. But the God of the New Testament is a God of love and compassion and kindness and mercy. Don't ever say that garbage, because it's not true. The God of the Old Testament is the same God as the New Testament God. And here is one of those places where he makes it very clear that his motivating desire is love and compassion. In the New Testament, we have displays of wrath and judgment, just like we have displays of wrath and judgment in the Old Testament. So we've got to quit buying into some of this bad teaching that there is a distinct difference between the God of the Old and the God of the New Testaments, because there isn't. It's the people that are the problem in both cases. God will judge those who need to be judged. He will have mercy on those who need to have mercy, and he will demonstrate his love to everyone in hopes that they will do what is right. Okay? Now let's get back to the very point, though, of this second commandment, and that is, you don't make physical representations of gods and goddesses. It's actually a subset of commandment number one. You don't worship other gods and goddesses, and you most definitely, in respect to those gods and goddesses, don't make representations of them to bow down and worship. The Jewish people morphed this over time. This is what I mean by that. This commandment is not about statues. It's not about decorations. It's not about paintings or carvings or photographs. It's about worship objects. Now, the Jewish people in the time of David and Solomon had artwork. They made representations of natural objects. For example, God told them in designing the temple to represent things like oxen or bulls. Remember that the great big gigantic water tank for the temple sat on the backs of 12 bulls, which represented the 12 tribes of Israel. Inside the temple, there were representations of cherubim, that is, the four-faced, four-winged angels. There were representations of trees and fruit that were part of the decorations throughout the temple. So the Jewish people clearly understood that artwork was acceptable. What was not acceptable was using artwork as a worship object. That is, making something that looks like the sun in the sky and then bowing down to it because you are worshiping the sun in the sky. Or making a calf, or bull, and bowing down to it because you're thinking it represents the God who created all things. That's what this commandment is against. Now, the Jewish people in Jesus' day and right afterwards, the Pharisees had so focused themselves on being the protectors of the law that they said, you can't make any type of representations of living creatures. So when you read through Josephus, he tells stories about how the Jewish people had been instructed not to make statues, not to make human forms, not to make animal forms, and that Solomon, and this is what Josephus actually says, that Solomon was engaging in sin when he made the oxen that went underneath the sea, underneath the water tank. Now, he was wrong. Josephus was absolutely wrong, because it was God that gave the directions on making those oxen. And so it is possible to over-apply or overextend an application of something God has given. And we've got to be careful not to engage in that. So there should be zero problem with Christians making objects of art, even objects which represent Jesus or God or things that God has done. The problem comes in when you make those objects in order to bow down before them and treat them as if they are God. So we've got to make that the line in the sand that we tell people they should not cross. Do not make images or icons in order to worship them. Let's go on to the next one. Verse number 7. And these first few commandments are specifically in relationship to Israel's relationship to God. So don't worship any other gods and goddesses. Don't make any type of idols that represent those gods and goddesses. And then verse number 7, number 3 on the commandment list, you shall not take the name of, and remember, the name that's originally here in Hebrew was Yahweh. That's the best English pronunciation that I can come across. It means he who is. So you shall not take the name of he who is your God in vain. For he who is will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now, what does it mean, take the name of God in vain? Again, the Pharisees of the first century, going into the time period after that, started teaching this idea that you can't say the name of God out loud. Instead, you need to substitute Adonai, or my Lord, for the divine name. And so they got into the habit of not even saying this name because they felt that that was the best way to avoid using it in vain. But was that the original intention of this commandment? No, it wasn't. The original intent of this commandment was something like what I tell people nowadays when I hear them using God's name in vain. I say, unless you're talking to him or about him, why are you even using a word about him? See, when we talk about God, it's appropriate that we use terminology regarding him. When we talk to him, it is appropriate for us to use his name. But when we are using it for a curse, when we are using it just for language that is empty of meaning, that's not appropriate. And so this is something that we need to teach people not to do. I really hate seeing and hearing God being spoken of as if he were just a curse word. And it needs to stop. And it shouldn't just stop because I happen to be in your presence, because I've actually talked to people like that when they say, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I offended you. My response is, well, it wasn't me that you offended. It's God. And so we need, I think, to bring back this air of respectability for God and his name, that he is not used as some sort of curse. One of the other things about this curse thing is making promises in his name without keeping the promise. That's using his name in vain. And it doesn't matter whether you intended to try to fake somebody out with that, or you just didn't feel the need to follow through with it. Both would be using the name of God in vain, which is one of the reasons in the New Testament Jesus warns against taking oaths at all. That your yes should simply mean yes and your no should simply mean no. When you start swearing on a stack of Bibles, or I swear before the God who created the universe that all this is true, you are engaging in misbehavior because you're trying to use God to manipulate other people's actions. And that's not appropriate. And so the New Testament teaches us that we should just be open and honest all the time. Verse number 8. And I know that this becomes a big sticking point for a lot of people. I don't want to go into all the details of it today. I think we will We will save it for a separate thing altogether to talk about the details of the Sabbath in regard to New Testament teaching. So verse number 8 says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now the Sabbath day for the Jewish people is the seventh day. And they've been taught that now, that they are now going to take that day off. The entire time that they were in Egypt, they didn't have time off as slaves. They worked 7 days a week, all the days of a year for their entire life. They didn't get holidays. They didn't get days off. So now God is saying, in the law system that I want you to adopt as a people, because you're now going to be your own ethnic group, you're going to be your own nation, you are going to have a protected day off every week. And it's the seventh day that you're going to use. And you're going to keep it special. Verse 9, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day, the seventh day is a Sabbath to he who is your God. On it, you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. So this seventh day of every single week is a day off for everybody and everything Even the animals get the day off because everybody needs downtime. It works best when the entire society is using the exact same day. Now, there are immediately exceptions to this that we have to talk about, which the Jewish people understood, which God made allowances for. The priests are going to work on the Sabbath day. More than likely, they would get some comp time because of that. But the sacrifices have to be offered 7 days a week. Their people have to have somebody representing them to God 7 days a week. So that means some priest or several priests are not going to get the Sabbath off. So they need a different day to take down. The people who have to do emergency things, such as an animal falls into a pit and it is in grave danger of dying. They couldn't control what day of the week it happened on, so they're going to have to get down there and lever them out if they're stuck in mud or whatever to save the animal's life. Same thing with a person. If a person is drowning because they decided to do a little bit of wading and a wave knocked them into the water deeper, you don't ignore that on the Sabbath day because you're not supposed to be doing any work. You save them. And Jesus teaches this in the New Testament, that the Jewish people understood this, that you do absolutely necessary emergency things on the Sabbath day because that's the right thing to do, to save a life, to preserve life. The point of the Sabbath day commandment is everybody needs downtime, so don't work yourself to death, and don't work anybody else to death. At one time, here in the Western world, and particularly I'm thinking about here in our United States, because of the Christian culture adopting the first day of the week as the day of worship, because that's the day of the week that Jesus resurrected from the dead, and in part because they wanted to be very much distinguished from the Jewish people, specifically the Jewish people that did not believe in Jesus, they adopted the first day of the week as their day off. And it was a mandatory day off for everybody. In my own lifetime, when I was a kid, I remembered nothing was opened on Sunday. There were no restaurants opened. Even gas stations didn't open up for the most part. No stores for sure. That started in my teen years, that they started having Sunday hours, and there was pushback from the Christian community at the time because they felt that this was going to result in everybody having to work 7 days a week without any time off. And guess what? They were kind of right, weren't they? So the point is every society needs to encourage people to take time off each week. Not everybody is going to be able to take the exact same day. It's convenient when most of the society is taking the same day. But because we are now living in a time that is post-Christian, we have to acknowledge that, it's not likely that we're going to see Sunday or Saturday as being an enforced day off for everyone. So my encouragement is that every Christian needs to live up to this standard and take time off. And sometimes that's hard because of our society being so driven to always be active. And so my wife is my helper in that. I obviously can't take Sunday morning off because I'm working. So there's another time period that I need to take off. And so she tries to help me be honest in that so that I can let my body relax. And because my job, like some of yours, is very much driven by thinking, I have to be careful that I don't start working on sermons in my head whenever I'm taking my time off. So I actually do have to engage in some means of focusing on something else, specifically to just relax and take time off. You may find the same thing. Workers in emergency services, people who have to be in hospitals, sometimes they have to miss the Sunday services that churches have because that's their day of work. But they still need to take some time off and still need to find a way to engage in religious fellowship and worship and things of that nature. Now, our technology allows us to do that a little bit better now, because if you work on Sunday, you still have a chance to maybe pick up on a video or an audio of a worship service on a different day. You can actually view something that happened on Sunday. So I think you understand what I'm trying to get at here, is the principle that is here is the most important part. And Jesus tries to teach that in the New Testament. Now, the particular day that the Israelis were given for this is picked because of creation. And that's brought up next, verse 11. For in 6 days he who is made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested the seventh day, not because he was tired, but because he was finished. Therefore, he who is blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So the principle is everybody needs to take a day off each week. And the most obvious day for that for the Jewish people was the seventh day of every week, because that was the day that God took off at the very beginning of the story. For those of us that are not Jewish, it may be a different day of the week, such as the first day of the week, Sunday, because of our relationship with Jesus being resurrected on that day. For others, because they have to work on those days, it may be another. But the point is, everybody needs time off.